Welcome to the Hidden Wire Podcast, episode 1101, my interview with David Gillespie. We're discussing his newest book, Toxic at Work, Decoding Psychopathic Behavior. Enjoy. Hey, David, welcome to the Hidden Wire Podcast. Great to have you here today.
Good to be here, Lee.
And local too. Usually I have someone overseas in America or somewhere, but you're just down the road, really.
Well, I'll try to be overseas next time then.
Please. So welcome to the show. You've got a couple of books that are intriguing, and that's why we've invited you on the show. And it's all about dealing with toxic people, really. You've got a few books, Taming Toxic People, your newest book, which is Toxic at Work. Tell us your background, Dave. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Okay, so my day job is a lawyer, and I guess the reason people are asking me to write books is because of a book I wrote a fair while ago now, back in 2007, called Sweet Poison, which is about why sugar makes us fat and all the other things it does to us. And I wrote that book because, I'd been steadily getting fatter for most of my life. By the time I'd had that, had four kids under the age of nine, and my wife rather inconsiderately told me that we were expecting twins. So after I got over blaming her for that, I decided that I wasn't coping with the four kids we already had, let alone adding twin babies to that, especially given that she was of the view, and I was very strongly supportive of this, that babies should be breastfed for the first 12 months of their lives. And she was planning to do that with twins, which meant that she wouldn't be doing much else around the house, because that's a pretty full-time operation. So I decided that I needed to get my act together and do something about my weight. Now, it's not like I hadn't done anything about it before. I'd read all the, you see stuff on the telly and so on about, low carb this and keto that and, walking the dog diet and all that sort of stuff. And I tried them all and they all worked. They all worked for exactly as long as my willpower held out, which was usually about 2 weeks. And then whatever weight I'd managed to lose, usually about a kilo a week, came back with interest. And I thought, look, I didn't buy the story that there'd been a mass loss of willpower in the last decade of the 20th century, and everyone had suddenly decided to become obese, including me. I don't buy that sort of thing. I like to understand how things work and why they work.
Sure.
And yeah. I drilled into what the science said rather than what the various health authorities continuously told us, which in essence was that fat makes us fat and that exercise makes us thin. Neither of those things can be empirically proven, it turns out, and there was no basis for the advice whatsoever. Turns out that what actually makes us fat is sugar, and that all you've got to do if you don't want to be fat is stop eating sugar, which is easier said than done, because now sugar is embedded in everything that we buy. You've got tomato sauce, which is 25% sugar, barbecue sauce, which is 55% sugar. The average breakfast cereal is 1/3 sugar.
55% sugar in barbecue sauce.
Yeah. There's less sugar in chocolate sauce than in barbecue sauce. When I discovered all of that and concertedly attempted to eliminate sugar, it worked. I lost 40 kilos. It stayed off since. Those twins are now 20 years old. But I wrote a book about what I did, and it got published, as I said, in 2007, a book called Sweet Poison, is, I think, one of the best-selling books, non-fiction books ever sold in Australia. And when you write a book like that, publishers are usually keen to let you write whatever you want to write. Well, 14 books later, we've got the one that you've been talking about, which is Toxic at Work. So I've written about a lot of topics, some in the nutrition space, like sugar and seed oils and why. I mean, seed oils, if anything, are even worse for us than sugar, because they have an intergenerational effect, and are likely to be responsible for childhood cancers, etc. But I've also written about psychology, for example, a book I wrote called Teen Brain, which is about how addiction is destroying the current generation of teenagers. One for adults called Brain Reset, which is how we can change the way our brain works when it comes to addiction, anxiety, depression, etc. But I've also sort of dabbled into the workplace, if you like, with the two books that you mentioned. So Toxic at Work and Taming Toxic People. And what these are about is what I call workplace psychopaths. Workplace psychopaths aren't any different to any other kind of psychopath. It's just that they're in a workplace. And people say, don't think I've ever encountered any axe murderers at work. And I guess that's the point where I should say my definition of psychopath. My definition of psychopath there are two types of people in the world. There are people who have evolved empathy and there are people who haven't. And I call those people psychopaths. I could have called them non-empaths, but
it's a pretty strong word or name for someone, isn't it?
Well, psychopath, I mean, if you go back to the original definition of psychopath, which was coined sort of in around the early 1940s by a psychologist, who was writing about people inside prison, but the characteristics he described now form the basis for the modern diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, which is only called that because they, in the late 1950s, the profession found that people were getting confused between the term psychopath and psychotic. Mostly because of the film Psycho, which came out in, 1956, the main character in that is a psychotic, not a psychopath, but, everyone got all confused. And so the profession started calling them narcissists and sociopaths instead. But rather than having a confusing array of terms for the same thing, I think it's best to just call them what they are. Don't do them favors by softening it at all. A psychopath is a person who wholly lacks empathy. About 1 in 20 humans are in that category. Another way to describe them is human version 1.0. So most humans during the last 100,000 years have evolved brain wiring called spindle neurons, which deal with detecting the emotions of others and taking them into account, which is what we commonly call empathy. About 1 in 20 of us have not evolved that capacity. So they're human 1.0 and the rest of us are human 2.0. But those people can get by in society, in fact, usually do quite well in certain types of societies. And so evolution has maintained them as a component of the gene pool, if you like.
Right. So there's some evolutionary background to it all.
Yep.
Why is it not evolved? Like, why don't you evolve with empathy if empathy's, majority of us are empathetic individuals?
Because it doesn't harm the individual. In fact, empathy is necessary for society to function. Without empathy, you can't. So humans are the only animal that is able to cooperate with strangers. And that's because we have something called trust. And trust is actually just, a psychological description of the wiring that goes into empathy. So we use a lot of shortcuts in the way we think and the way we deal with other humans. But the end result is that we trust other humans. And we especially trust other humans that look like us, that sometimes gets categorized as racism religious division or whatever you want. But those are one of the shortcuts that the human brain uses. Now, that's all built on top of this wiring for empathy. If without trust, we can't cooperate as a group, and then we are like all other animals on the planet. So no other animal on the planet works with strangers. So when you see groupings of animals, say something like elephants or someone, or wolves, they are not a group of strangers. They are family. They're all related to each other in some way. Humans, uniquely amongst animal species, can cooperate as a group of strangers. And that gives us an enormous power because if you think about it, we're the apex predator on the planet. But we're a pretty rubbish apex predator. We've got no claws, no thorns, no venom, no sharp teeth, no armor, nothing. In fact, one-on-one with a crocodile, we'd definitely come off second best. In fact, one-on-one with just about anything at the top of the predatory tree, we'd come off second best. But we don't deal one-on-one. We deal as a group. Yeah. And as a group, we can cooperate. And as a group, we can invent. And as a group, we can build on each other's achievements. And as a group, we beat everything every time. And so that's the advantage empathy gives us. It gives us that ability. Now, at a personal level, however, it's a disadvantage in that someone without empathy can take real advantage of the fact that everybody else acts in the interests of the group, and that gives them the ability to act in their own interests without any regard to the interests of the group, and that's what psychopaths do. So that's why psychopaths are extremely bad people to have in organizations. They are fine to have if they are individuals and no one is relying on them or trusting them. If you want them as part of a team or part of an organization where you are trying to create something bigger than an individual can create, so that might be a sporting club, it might be a community group, it might be your workplace, anything where you have a grouping of people coming together to achieve something as a communal outcome, which is not necessarily in their own personal best interests. I mean, obviously their personal interests should be aligned with the community outcome, but each individual action is not necessarily in their personal best interest. Now, to a psychopath, that's playground, because they've got all these people who are working for the community good and leaving opportunities to enrich themselves. So, for example, if they were to get involved in, say, a sporting club or something like that, you'd have people doing things on a voluntary basis or acting in the community best interests. You know, they might, implement processes, for example, to ensure fair selection of paid opportunities in the club and things like that. Whereas a psychopath would see no necessity for that whatsoever. And they would just ensure that if there was any money going about, it would end up in their pocket. So that happens all the time, and it happens not just in sporting clubs, in voluntary organisations, but in businesses. And that sort of behaviour can seriously degrade the ability of a business to function. One of the things I talk about in detail in that latest book, Toxic at Work, is examples of how that has happened and how businesses have stopped it happening. And so I'm hoping that when someone reads through them, they'll see exactly something, it'll ring bells with them. They'll see something happening in those examples that is happening in front of their eyes today in their business.
Okay. So protecting their business and potentially the downside of having a psychopath within their workplace.
Yeah, well, if they're 1 in 20, then if you're a workplace of 20 or more people, you've got at least one there.
1 in 20, yeah, well, okay. How do we identify a psychopath, whether it's in the workplace or in our personal lives? Because I don't really want to relate just to the workplace.
No. It's the same in your personal life. Obviously, they don't stop being a psychopath when they come home. In relationships, they're extremely dangerous and we're starting to recognize that with, bringing in laws that recognize psychological oppression as a form of domestic violence just as much as hitting people. And that's targeted at this personality type. So these are people who, once again, are not interested in the welfare of their partner. They're not interested in making their partner's lives better. Their partner is merely a servant to their interests. So their relationship is all about what enriches them, and the partner is there to make that happen. I guess obvious ways to recognize a psychopath in a relationship or anywhere else is they're intensely manipulative. So you'll find them doing what's, people refer to this as gaslighting, but it's really lying.
If they're good at manipulation, I mean, can we identify that? Like if they're very good at manipulation, like I would have thought it's something hard to sometimes identify if they're
artists. That's the trick in the sense that initially we don't. When you first meet a psychopath, they're going to be the most impressive person you've ever met. Yeah. Most people will come away from a meeting with a psychopath saying that is the best job applicant I've ever seen or potential partner I've ever seen. They're incredible. And the reason for that is that they, whilst they lack what we call cognitive empathy, which is the bit that makes us work as a community, you know, where we are on autopilot acting in the best interests of others. But they have, they lack emotional empathy. What they have in spades is cognitive empathy, which they've had to train themselves to do, recognizing that they have no emotional empathy. So from a very young age, they've realized they have no emotional empathy, but they've realized that we can tell if they don't start acting like they do. So they play it. And that's called cognitive empathy. So it isn't as fast or as well adapted as emotional empathy, but it does a reasonable facsimile. So they're really, really good at reading our emotions. They can tell what we're thinking and they can tell what the appropriate response is because they spent their whole life training for it. So they're excellent at mirroring. So
they can't develop emotional empathy?
No, they can't.
No,
because it's a wiring problem. So it's a lack of a certain type of neuron in the brain. So by the age of four, they either have it or they don't. By the way, all babies are psychopaths. We're not born with emotional empathy. It's something which grows in the human brain between the age of zero and the age of four. Yeah.
Interesting.
So by the time
how do you know if my baby at four or five is lacking emotional empathy?
Pay attention to some of the things that I'm about to say, which is the obvious signs, particularly in a child, is in manipulative behavior. So if you see a child attempting to manipulate others, and by then they aren't that practiced, so it's a bit clunky. If you see a child harming others without concern for how they might feel, so it's remember what empathy is. It's taking others' feelings into account in your behavior. Right. If the child clearly doesn't care how someone else feels, if they're often people report they're prone to doing things like hurting pets, insects, other animals, etc., without any concerns whatsoever. They lie persistently and are very, very good at talking their way out of lies. So always have a plausible explanation for something, and so on. And then once you get to adult stage, they've had, 20, 30, 40 years of practicing this, so they're a lot better at it. And so when you first meet a psychopath as an adult, as I said, they will project whatever you want them to be. So that's why we come away from a meeting with them thinking, wow, that guy's perfect, because they're excellent at reading what we want. They listen to what we say. They might even do some research on our interests if they're applying for a job, and they'll tell us whatever we want to hear. And they're not constrained by truth. Now, most people will lie if they have to get themselves an advantage, but they'll draw limits to that. So they won't completely make up their resume, or they won't completely make up an employer, or they won't completely make up former partners or a history in their life. But a psychopath has no qualms doing that whatsoever. They'll lie consistently and persistently because they'll tell you whatever you want to hear. And most of us avoid lying because we're worried about the consequences to a large degree. We're worried about, what if they check that and find out that that's not true? Whereas a psychopath has no concern for the future whatsoever. And I'll tell you about some interesting experiments on that. But they have no concerns about the future. They have no anxiety about the future at all. They'll do whatever is necessary to get through the moment. So if you need to hear that I'm a rocket scientist, then I'm a rocket scientist. And maybe you'll check and maybe you won't, but that's a problem for tomorrow. So they live in the moment. They're entirely zen in a way. And to illustrate that point, there's some interesting experiments done on psychopaths and pain. So they did some experiments in prison settings. So when they first were studying psychopaths intently in the 1970s in prisons, and what they would do is they'd get groups of prisoners who were matched by crime and intensity of crime, but some they believed were psychopaths and some they weren't based on some testing that they'd done. And they put them both through the same experiment, which is that they wired them up to an electrode that would deliver a really quite nasty electric shock. It wouldn't kill them or severely injure them, but it wasn't pleasant. And then they would tell them that that shock would be set off in 8 seconds, and they would count it down, 8, 7, 6, etc. And all the time they were wired up to things that would measure the skin conductance and so on, that would give them an estimate of the person's anxiety about what was about to happen. Right. So there was no surprises here. You knew you're wired up, and in 8 seconds you're going to get a nasty electric shock. The first time they did that, they found that as you get closer and closer to zero, people who weren't psychopaths become more and more anxious about it. People who were psychopaths, it didn't seem to bother them at all. So there was no difference in their anxiety levels, you know, before or after. And they recorded that as exhibiting no fear. But it's not really no fear. It's a lack of anticipation of consequences. And when they did it, you know, and then they do a repeat of that, and then a repeat of it, and a repeat of it. And every time they repeated it, the normal subjects became more and more anxious. They're anxious from the moment they attached electrodes.
Right.
Psychopaths couldn't care less. It made no difference to them whatsoever. They knew what was happening. They'd experienced it already. It didn't make any difference at all to the way they reacted. And that's because that lack of wiring also helps us deal with consequences. It's a forward planning capability. And psychopaths lack that entirely. So they will happily lie to you because they don't fear the consequences. It's also why you can't threaten a psychopath. You can't say, if you don't do this thing that I want you to do, I will go to the police or report you to the authorities or tell on you, or, you know, depending on the age. To a psychopath, that's meaningless. It's completely meaningless. It isn't going to change their behavior at all, because if that happens, it happens, but it isn't going to change what they're going to do now. And it makes them very, very difficult to deal with in a workplace, because that is actually a behavior modifier in the workplace, where people don't behave in certain ways because of fear of consequences. So, you know, it helps people act in the interests of the group.
Would it be the same with reward, as far as not just a negative context, but if there was a cake at the end of the road? Would they not care either way?
No. The interesting thing is that with reward, they're highly sensitive to reward. So with reward, it actually does motivate them. And if you need to motivate a psychopath, the only way you can do it is with reward. And there's some interesting experiments on this on a juvenile detention facility in the United States called Mendota, where they try this. They set up the facility to take out the hardcore juvenile offenders in the prison system. They thought they were setting it up for people with psychosis, right? But in fact, what they ended up getting, who were just referrals from the main prison system, were psychopaths, because they were the people that the main prison system just couldn't do anything with. They couldn't punish them into submission. They weren't going to change their behavior. They were highly manipulative. They were highly wrecking within the community of the prison system. And so they were shipped out to this place. And what the folks at Mendota had to do was try and design a way to control a group of psychopaths, knowing that punishment just wouldn't do it. If punishment would have worked, it would have already worked in the mainstream system. And what they found is they designed a system that was sort of like a frequent flyer system. Every little bit of positive behavior the person exhibited earned them points towards rewards, you know, like extra chocolate bars, more free time, access to movies, access to gaming, you know, all of those sorts of things. So as they got more and more points, they got access. And if they did something bad, then they lost points, which would slow down their progress through the reward system. So they found that it enabled them to control a population of psychopaths by giving them relatively small rewards. And that's the other interesting thing about psychopaths, is that the size of the reward doesn't matter. It's the fact that there's a benefit to them is the important thing. So there's a classic, mind game that you can play that they do in psychology game theory, where they say, you're in control of a switch on a railway. It's called the trolley car problem. It's been around since the 60s. And on one branch of the railway, there's one man who's going to be killed if the train goes down that way. And on another branch of the railway, there's five people who will be killed if the train goes down that way. Either way, you're going to kill at least one person. Which one do you, you know, you, and you've got to make a choice, which do you do? And it's a classic problem that they put to people. A lot of people find that impossible to resolve. They don't want to kill anyone. But the problem requires them to make a decision. So, yeah. What they found is that about 60% of us will choose the one where one person dies and five people live. 40% of us refuse to participate at all. And psychopaths behave normally. They come in at about the 60% with most people because they just figure that's what most people will answer. And so that's what they... which shows, of course, how what deep insight they have into the human condition, if you like. And they always favour the option which makes them not stand out from the crowd. But if you change the problem a little bit and have them get a personal reward, even as small as a dollar, for choosing one option over the other, then that's the option they'll choose. In life in general, psychopaths will always choose the option which advantages them. And they have no regard to whether or not that option might damage the organization. So you might be, as I said, in an organization and they have a choice, something which might harm the organization but advantage them, they'll choose that option every single time. Whereas a normal person will always have an eye to the good of the organization. It's why they're harmful, and in a relationship the same thing's rolling. You know, if it's a choice, if there isn't a choice that matters to them in the sense that either option is going to be the same as far as they're concerned, then they'll behave like a normal person. But if there's any part of the decision which results in an advantage to them, regardless of what effect it might have on their partner, they'll choose that option.
Toxic in relationships too. So if in that example of the one person or five people, if there was a reward behind the five people, you'd naturally assume the psychopath would choose that way.
Yeah. Because absolutely. Yeah. If one of the five people was their mother, it didn't matter. So a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, the rules would be different if it were a relation of theirs or someone they cared about. Well, the answer is no, it isn't, because they don't care about anyone other than themselves. So psychopaths don't understand a concept of love. It's just a weakness that many of us have, which they feel they can exploit if necessary.
I wonder if there's been any studies done where they haven't been preconditioned, in that case where, you know, they obviously know the better choice than most people would choose is the one person dying.
I think they can figure it out. As I said, psychopaths have spent most of their life living amongst us. Right. And their primary aim is not to be detected as a psychopath. They know that if we know that they are a psychopath, we'll reject them. They know that humans will reject someone who won't behave in the best interests of the group. That's the other side of our wiring for empathy, is that it's an in-group, out-group thing. It's facilitated by a hormone called oxytocin. But if you're doing what the group wants, then you receive the favor of the group. But if you're not doing what the group wants, then you're excommunicated. And they're well aware of that dynamic, have been since a very early age, have probably had direct experience of it as a child. And they spend most of their lives trying not to be detected as a psychopath, which is why they bothered developing cognitive empathy at all, because they've got to at least pretend to care about the group.
That allows them to give some sense of belonging to a group that will obviously advantage them somehow.
Well, if you were employing someone, for example, and they lobbed in the door and said, oh, by the way, I'm a psychopath, you'd ask them to leave immediately, right? Yeah, even if they said, oh, by the way, I only act in my own best interest and don't give a damn about the organization, you'd also ask them to leave, even if they didn't call themselves a psychopath. So they're not going to do that. They're going to do the opposite of that, which is come in and tell you whatever you want to hear. And the same goes for that in a relationship. You wouldn't enter into a relationship that says someone says, look, I'll be abusive to you and exploit you every chance I get. They're not going to say that and expect to have a relationship. But if they come to you and say exactly what you want to hear, tell you all of the things that you feel have been missing in all your previous partners, then they've got a very good chance of getting you into a relationship. And then once you're there, In essence, you become addicted to the maltreatment because of some wiring with respect to the way we deal with dopamine, which I won't go into in detail unless you want me to. In essence, you become an addict, which is why people find it so difficult to exit out of relationships with psychopaths.
Right. This oxytocin, is that lacking in psychopaths? Some of these happy chemicals?
Oxytocin is not lacking, they lack the receptors for it. So the particular things that are missing from a psychopath's brain contain receptors for oxytocin, which motivate our behavior. And they don't have those receptors. So whilst they still can produce oxytocin, they don't have any way of receiving the signals from it. And so it has no effect on them. So some interesting experiments were done with oxytocin. Yeah, okay. Oxytocin sprays. So we know, for example, that you can induce people to behave in a more empathetic fashion by giving them a squirt of oxytocin up the nostrils. So just a little spray thing, you know, like those cold things. Yeah. You can induce people to behave more empathetically. But if the person's a psychopath, it has no effect on them whatsoever. There's some interesting, the interesting animal studies, because there are some species of animal that have the ability to develop empathy. Some types of rodent, for example, the prairie vole is one of them that has the ability to develop empathy. And you can tell because often an external indicator of whether a species can do this or not is whether or not it can have monogamous long-term relationships. So normal voles, they're kind of rat in essence. Normally, you know, sex is a 3-second affair and no one's hanging around to be a parent. It's a transactional thing. Whereas the prairie vole doesn't do that. It partners for life. It protects the partner. It protects the young. And when they've analyzed the brains of prairie voles versus the other species of vole, what they've found is exactly that difference. So the lacking in these particular neurons. And they've narrowed that down to, also a failure in these oxytocin receptors.
Okay. Is it possible for empathetic people maybe even in current society, I don't know if this is an evolving trend or something, is it possible for empathetic people to have more psychopathic tendencies?
Oh, absolutely.
To benefit themselves.
People will always act in their own best interest, but what empathy does is constrain that action.
Right.
So empathy forces us to take account of the welfare of others in our decisions to some degree or another. It does not mean that empaths cannot be criminals. Of course they can be criminals. Empaths can hurt people. Of course they can in the right circumstances. But an empath is always taking account of the consequences and the wishes of others and the welfare of others. So that's always a moderating influence, whereas a psychopath is doing none of those things. A psychopath is always just acting in their own best interest without regard for consequences or the welfare of others. Now, as you pointed out, does it differ from society to society? Because if this is a biological thing, it should be the same in all humans regardless. And the answer is it is the same in all humans regardless. It's about 1 in 20. But some societies are much better at controlling it than others. So there's some really interesting big studies done on differences in societies. So some societies are at what we would call the communal end of the spectrum. So particularly in South America, places like Colombia and so on, where people behave according to a lot of communal rules about how they behave, where there's an expectation that everybody is behaving in the best interests of the community. Australian Aboriginals, at least in the ancestral form, had exactly the same approach. So it's the closer a society is to having to supply food and shelter, so the closer it is to the basic needs of humans, the more likely it is to be a communal society. Communal societies tend to have better controlled psychopaths. So they're still there, but they don't have a choice. They have to behave in the interest of the communities, because if they don't, they're instantly detected and rejected. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, societies like the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia are all at the high end of this. There's actually a scale for this. It goes from about, 0 to 100. And Australia, the UK, and the US are all up in the high 90s in this scale, which is the individualism scale. And that's the extent to which the interests of the individual are prioritized over the interests of the group. And you can tell that within the structure of the way businesses and communities run in those societies, which is that there are very loose group controls, right? There are no serious punishments for failure to act in the best interests of the group. There's a lack of structure. People are promoted on the basis of whim or extraordinary performance or just people like them, rather than on the basis of a predetermined structure where you grind your way through. So it's, if you were to compare maybe the Australia of immediately post the Second World War with the Australia of today, you would say post the Second World War, there was a strong community focus of recovering from the war. Everyone's welfare mattered. We rise as a society. Whereas now, Australian society very much has an individualistic attitude, which is you're in it for yourself and whatever you can get. Now, that doesn't mean we're all psychopaths, but it does mean that psychopaths have a much easier time in a society like that because they don't stand out so much.
Yeah, and I would think for the individual that has empathy that maybe the consequences don't matter as much, so therefore the psychopathic tendency might come out more too in that sort of environment.
Well, yeah, there's less punishment for not behaving in the best interests of the group, and there's less structure forcing you to behave in the best interests of the group.
So you can kind of see that in today's society, can't you, more and more problems going on because people don't seem to have this sense of consequence.
Well, that's right. Youth. Yeah. That's something else probably related to one of the other books I've written, going on there, which is that what we've done in the last 10 years is quite explicitly change the wiring. There's a part of the human brain which can be changed by addiction, and by putting addictive capabilities in the pocket of every teenager on the planet, we're changing the way their brains work and predisposing them to a brain state which has a lot less impulse control, a lot higher levels of anxiety, a lot higher levels of depression. So we're at the start of a fairly significant problem in our society, which is that we've taken addiction and given it to an entire generation and rewired their brains. And that is going to be a real problem in 20 years' time. It's starting, we're just seeing the tip of it now with, for example, in Queensland, the assault rate in Queensland, for example, I think has tripled in the last 4 or 5 years. So that's just the start of it because we are now introducing mass level addiction to the human brain during the teen years, which is a time when it's under when the bit about impulse control is being built. And so anyway, that's a topic for an entirely different book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I've written about in Teen Brain.
With the psychopaths, identifying them, can we control them at all, or is it just best to remove them from our lives or workplaces or whatever it might be?
Removing them is always the best option. Doing it is a lot harder than it sounds.
Yeah.
For example, in a workplace, if your boss is a psychopath, you don't have any choices. They have total control of the situation. They have total control of you. If you try going around them to their boss, they'll have already set their boss up with a narrative that says you are the problem, not them. They have plenty of time to do that. And I work through in a lot of detail in the book Toxic at Work exactly how they do that and show you how it's done. At the end of the day, there are not many good strategies against this. The strategies boil down to getting out of there as fast as you can. But what I can do and what I do is set out a whole series of strategies you can use to protect yourself while you're doing that. If you're in a different position with respect to psychopaths, so if you're their boss, then you have more options. But the first problem you're going to have is knowing they're a psychopath, because remember, they'll be spending most of their time convincing you they're not. So And you'll be hearing lots of stories about people below them over who you have less visibility, who are the real problem, and they are trying, you know, to manage as well as they can, given the terrible team that they have to deal with. But there are external indicators that you can see as a manager that you are employing a psychopath. One of them is that your sick leave and absenteeism in general goes through the roof. So once there's a psychopath in a workplace, the people below the psychopath will have a hell of a time at work. They will be stressed. They will be depressed. They'll be anxious. They'll feel like they're walking on eggshells the entire time. They will be using their sick leave to the maximum. So that is always the first indicator, the first red flag in a workplace, that suddenly a workplace that was just fine is suddenly everyone's going off sick all the time. So that should prompt a good manager to start investigating. And that investigation involves talking to the people below the psychopath, not talking to the psychopath. So that's a tip for hiring managers as well, of course, is don't talk to the people they give you as references. talk to the people who would have worked for them in whatever organization they say they worked for, because they will give you the correct read on what this person is like. Now, organizations have managed to control psychopaths very successfully. And those, so one of them is Costco, and I go through it in quite a bit of detail in the book, where the implementing a series of structural changes has helped them totally control psychopaths. They're an organization that employs hundreds of thousands of people. Obviously, they employ psychopaths. But they can control them and control them very well. And there's some very interesting studies done out of the US on companies that have CEOs who are psychopaths and companies that have CEOs who aren't, and the difference in their performance financially, and it is significant. The companies that don't have psychopaths at the top do significantly better than companies who do, because of the destructive effect they have on the community of the organization, which impairs its abilities to produce a community outcome. In a business's case, that's money. And the same thing goes in relationships as well. You know, you will know if you're in a relationship with a psychopath. There will be no doubt about it in your mind. You'll be lied to constantly. You'll be manipulated constantly. You'll be the subject of if not violence, then violence via manipulation, psychological violence. And you will know it for absolute certain. But you will find it very, very difficult to leave. Because the psychopath has, by the time they feel safe enough to be doing that to you, they have a hold over you and they know it. So they will alternate pleasure and pain, in the sense that they will deliver the pain to you, but they'll also reel you back in with love bombing. So it is very, very difficult to leave a psychopath. But most people in those relationships definitely do want to do it. It's just very, very difficult to do. So I talk about those sorts of things in more detail in the book, in what are the strategies that you can follow to disentangle yourself from a psychopath.
Right. How do you know if you're a psychopath? Like, can you do a test?
Well, I guess the first test is if you're asking the question, then you're not. psychopaths know they're psychopaths. They don't need to test themselves. They've known since a very young age. They might not have a label for it, but they know they are very different to everybody else. They've known from the very first time they're in a group and saw something horrible happen to another person or to a member of the group, and they just felt curiosity about what had happened, whereas everybody else was horrified and feeling pain and other emotions. And they look around at that and they say, geez, what is wrong with these people? And then they've understood, I don't think the same way as all these other people think. An adult psychopath already knows. They might, as I said, they might not have a label for it, but they know they don't think the same way as anybody else. And they also understand that the way everybody else thinks is a significant weakness that they can take advantage of and will generally do so.
Okay. Fascinating. What, David, interested, because you sound like you do research a lot of topics, and I certainly would love to get you back on the show to discuss a few of them individually.
Yeah, of course.
What gets you excited to research psychopaths and then write books about this particular topic?
Most of the things that I write books about are to do with direct experience that I've had. And and so obviously I've had direct experience of psychopaths. And when it first happened with me, I didn't know what I was dealing with. And that's what most people encounter when they first encounter a psychopath, just total confusion. I don't understand why this person is behaving this way. Surely they wouldn't possibly hurt me or the organization just for that benefit. Is often the sort of thing people say when they encounter one, and they are struggling to explain why they feel the way they do around this person, which is usually like they're walking on eggshells. And so I wanted to understand why, you know, what is it that we're looking at here? And once again, the mainstream answers are pretty rubbish. There are good reasons why the psychology profession doesn't provide psychopathy as a diagnosis. The good historical reasons, which I delve into in a fair bit in the book. But the end result is that one of the most common psychological disorders in our society, skates by under the radar. And it's probably one of the most destructive. So I don't think they're doing anyone a service by not properly exploring this. We dealt with psychopaths better in the 1940s and 1950s because we were prepared to acknowledge they existed and what they were and how to deal with them than the profession does now when they're pretending they don't exist.
Right. Like a lot of things in society at the moment.
Yeah. So all the books and topics that I write about, as I said, my day job is a lawyer. So I haven't written any books about law and I don't plan to. I guess the value I bring in the topics that I write about is as an outsider to all of the topics, whether it's psychology, nutrition, or education, because I've written about the schooling system as well, that I'm an outsider. My job doesn't depend on what I write. I am simply looking at what the evidence says and telling you.
I like it.
So
has this always been a thing of yours, like where you've had this fascination?
I've always wanted to know how things work. Let's put it that way. I can't.
The big why question.
That's right. I can't stop investigating something until I'm satisfied. I have a logically sustainable model of what is going on. And
I like it.
When I do that, I write a book about it generally.
You must have a lot of topics that you have to just put on the back burner.
I do. And the next book is a collection of those. Haven't felt it was big enough to write a whole book about it, but which still required some discussion. So an example of one of those is there's a chapter in there on why sunscreens don't do what you think they're doing and why they're probably not saving you from melanoma. So that's not a book's worth. It's a chapter.
This must eat a lot of your time. It must be one of your passions in life.
Everyone's got to have a hobby.
That's yours.
Interesting,
isn't it? Because I mean, I do the podcast here and really I don't work on cars and do other things that other people might do or go jet skiing. I spend a lot of my time doing this. So like yourself, no doubt. Fascinating, mate. Well, look, I appreciate it. Would love to get you back on. And thank you so much for joining us for this episode. We'll be in touch.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Lee.
Guys, thanks for listening. You can check it out, as always, at thehiddenwhy.com.au. Until next time, peace, passion and purpose. See you soon. Thanks, guys, for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. I hope you love what you're hearing. If you like this episode, guys, or any of the episodes that you're listening to here at The Hidden Why, please do me a favor by sharing it. You can share it with your families. You can share it with your loved ones. You can do that by using your favorite social media channels, using the icons on the platform that you're listening to The Hidden Why podcast. Also, guys, if you're a fan of the show, please connect with me. Connect with me at thehiddenwhy.com. I love to hear from you. I love to converse with the people that listen to this show to find out what they enjoy, what they don't enjoy, and perhaps if they have any questions or feedback for the show as well. You can stay up to date with all that I'm releasing here, guys. I do a solo show every Monday, a 3-minute thought every Thursday. I do 2 interviews a week on a Wednesday and a Saturday, and a book review every Friday.
You can stay up to date with all that by subscribing to my newsletter at thehiddenwire.com. Just enter your email address there, and also subscribing to the podcast on the platform that you choose to listen to your podcasts. You can also support the show, guys, by using the Amazon links at thehiddenwire.com. So if you like books, you can get all the books that I review there, and anything else really that you like to purchase through Amazon. So use that link and help support the show. And we've also got a deal with Audible, guys. Audible is a fantastic way to listen to all your favorite books. We've got a deal with them so you can get 2 free books when you subscribe subscribe to a 30-day free trial. So check that out again at thehiddenwire.com. Guys, that's it from me. You know what to do. Go out there, breathe more passion into every single moment. Do everything with greater purpose, and in doing so, you will discover your hidden why. This is The Hidden Why. My name is Lee Martinuzzi. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon.